described these two pathways kind of in a rush at the end of the last lecture. Divergent and convergent pathways are, as far as how they are spatially arranged, opposites of each other. Convergence means coming together. Divergence means splitting apart. And as you look at how they are arranged, it's obvious how they got their names. But the physiological implications of this is what I want to repeat. In a divergent pathway, since you have a fewer number of upstream neurons and a greater number of downstream neurons, that means that a single signal from the central nervous system, let's say, can have effects in many different parts of the body. In other words, each of these terminal neurons can be going to a different effector. So that means divergent pathways have a pretty big sphere of influence. A convergent pathway, on the other hand, means that many different inputs from different parts of the body can influence the same part of the brain. All right? Because it's like a funneling in of information into one place. Slide 31 is a little cartoon that tries to get across the point that in the central nervous system, there can be quite a few neurons that are synapsing with the same downstream neuron at the dendrites of that neuron. So all of these blue things represent hacked off axon terminals or presynaptic terminals, each from a different axon. And they're in the central nervous system, there can be literally thousands of neurons that all connect to one downstream neuron, which, as you might expect, leads to very increased complexity. Because you have, the more feedback loops, the more connections you have, the more complexity there can be in, if you think of this as electronic circuitry, for instance, which is really what it is analogous to in a lot of ways, not only because of the connections, but because of, in at least some ways, the nervous system works in a binary fashion, meaning either on or off, which is what computers work on, ones and zeros, is either the switch is closed or the switch is opened electronically. Well, that's analogous to a neuron either firing an action potential or not firing an action potential. And the more complex the wiring is, the more complex the processing can be. So this is just a cartoon that shows you that there can be a lot of convergence, because all of these blue things are upstream neurons, all connecting to one downstream neuron. And not surprisingly, it's the dendrites of the downstream neuron that serve as the connection points, because dendrites are receivers of the neurons. But still, regardless of how many dendrites that neuron has, that downstream neuron, it still only has one axon. Now that axon might branch, but it still has one connection point, one axon hillock, and therefore one place that is either going to be brought to threshold or not brought to threshold. If it's brought to threshold, then that axon hillock is going to initiate an action potential by opening up those voltage-gated sodium ion channels. And whether this axon is just one unbranched axon, or that axon branches into many, many different branches, which are called collateral axons, if the neuron fires, then every one of those axons has to carry that action potential. In other words, just because an axon branches doesn't allow that neuron to say, well, I'm going to send the action potential down this branch, but not the other branch. Because they're all connected, the chain reaction that propagates action potentials occurs in all branches. Okay? Slide 32 introduces the notion of summation. Summation refers to adding together things, of course. What get added together in summation are graded local potentials. Remember that the immediate effect of a neurotransmitter being released into a synaptic cleft is the binding of that neurotransmitter to some sort of ion channel in general, and therefore opening or closing a gated ion channel. And the immediate effect of opening or closing a gated ion channel is changing the distribution of charged particles from one side of the membrane to the other. In other words, neurotransmitters cause changes in the membrane potential at the dendrite. It's at rest until it's disturbed from rest by redistributing ions, which can be accomplished by opening up ion channels. All right? Those changes from resting potential are what graded potentials are. And remember, they can come in two varieties, either an upswing on the graph or a downswing on the graph. An upswing is accomplished if the inside of the cell is made more positive. That is called a depolarizing local potential. A downswing takes it even farther away from threshold, makes it even more negative on the inside. That's a hyperpolarizing potential. Hyperpolarizing potentials make that cell even less likely to create an action potential. It's already not, if it's at rest, it's already not going to create an action potential because you have to be up at threshold. Hyperpolarizing makes it even less likely. Well, why would you ever need to have a hyperpolarizing potential then, since you're not going to have an action potential anyway at rest? Because of summation. Because different inputs can be happening at the same time on this one downstream neuron. And those inputs are combinations of depolarizing or hyperpolarizing potentials, which actually are like votes. Votes as to whether or not that neuron is going to fire. A depolarizing potential is like a yes vote. A hyperpolarizing potential is like a no vote. And a no vote can undo a yes vote, right? Well, the summation process is like tallying the votes. So what you have here in 32, slide 32, is one of two kinds of summation being illustrated, and this is called spatial summation. Spatial meaning in space. So it's the summation or the adding together of different local potentials that are occurring at different places on that downstream neuron, at the cell, different places on the cell body of the downstream neuron. So each of those pluses with the circles, notice, occur in a presynaptic terminal of an upstream axon. So there's three, in this simple example, there's three upstream neurons. Each of them happens to be firing or sending an action potential, and each of them happens to be releasing a neurotransmitter that's going to open up a channel that's going to cause a depolarizing potential. That's why they're all pluses. So all of these are depolarizing potentials that are resulting from the stimulation of the dendrite. All right? And by the way, what kind of ion flow would you expect there to be? What kind of ion channels would you expect to be opened for the depolarizing potentials to occur? sodium ions. Good, because sodium is positive plus, that's not enough for it to be positive. It's positive plus it's always in higher concentration in the extracellular fluid. That means it wants to diffuse into the cell. An importation of positives into the cell sends the membrane potential towards zero, which is up. Zero is above threshold, so it sends it towards threshold. That's why it's depolarizing. Well, in this case, each of these individual depolarizing local potentials is sub-threshold, meaning not quite strong enough on its own to bring it up to threshold and therefore cause an action potential. But remember that local potentials travel over the surface of the membrane, although they dissipate as they travel. So as you get farther and farther away from where they are created, the magnitude gets smaller. Still, though, as they travel, they make their way toward this trigger zone, which is at the axon hillock. That's the integration point, remember. That's the place where either an action potential is going to be created or not, based on whether that trigger zone membrane is at threshold. So each of these little sub-threshold local potentials add up, and even though they're each individually insufficient, when they add up, that brings it above threshold. That brings the trigger zone above threshold, and therefore, automatically, an action potential is created, because that threshold is the special voltage that opens up the voltage-gated sodium ion channels. It also starts opening up the voltage-gated potassium ion channels, but remember, they're slower to open. So the sodium ion channels quickly open up. That makes a very quick flow of sodium ions into the cell, which accounts for the very steep rise that is called the depolarization phase of the action potential. And then it propagates by chain reaction all the way down the axon, not losing any strength as it goes. Action potentials don't lose strength because each action potential actually creates a brand new action potential next to it. Okay, so that's spatial summation. But spatial summation can also involve summation of both depolarizing and hyperpolarizing potentials, and that's what you see in 33. So here's what I meant by yes and no votes. In the previous slide, we had three yes votes. They were sufficient to bring it to threshold. Now you have two yes votes and a no vote, and that no vote will undo a yes vote. And like I said before, in that the cartoon with all the blue things, there can be literally thousands of upstream neurons, and so summation can be quite complex, but it still is a matter of whether the axon hillock is brought to threshold or not, and that's because of the all or none aspect of action potentials. All right, but this is spatial summation still, because the individual local potentials are applied at different points in space. On the other hand, there can be what is called temporal summation. This is slide 34. Temporal means of time. That's why these parts are called your temples. The temporal bone and the temples get their name because in male humans, at least, or more so, this is where people start to gray, and therefore it's an indication of their age. Anyway, temporal means of time. And temporal summation is a little bit different, because now you have just a single upstream neuron that is causing a local potential on the downstream neuron, and it could be either hyperpolarizing or depolarizing. But for temporal summation to actually occur, well, for it to lead to an action potential, of course, it's going to have to be depolarizing. In any case, what is adding up here is not individual local potentials at different places on the dendrites. Instead, it's one upstream neuron delivering multiple action potentials, and therefore causing multiple local potentials at the same place. Now, in the left graph on this slide, there is no summation because the two local potentials, which are A1 and A2 in the graph, are spaced too far apart in time. By the time the second jolt is given to this downstream neuron, the first jolt, the first graded potential, has already dissipated and it's back to resting membrane potential. And since neither individual local potential was up to threshold, there's no action potential created. On the other hand, if you increase the frequency of the action potentials at the upstream neuron, that means you're spacing those action potentials closer in time. That means those action potentials are causing more closely spaced in time local potentials in the downstream neuron. And here, you can, there is summation. A1 is starting to dissipate, as you see. It's starting to come back down. But it, before it gets a chance to get back down to rest, A2 comes along and leaves and starts where the other one left off. So that's enough for it to get up to threshold. It's kind of like taking three steps up, only one step back, and then three steps up again. You get higher in the ladder if you do that, if you don't come all the way back down to where you started before you rise again. So, as always, anything that brings that axon-Hillock plasma membrane to threshold potential is going to cause automatically an action potential. But you see the fundamental distinction between the two types of summation? And, of course, the two kinds of summation can happen simultaneously. So you can have, and that's really what usually happens, you have multiple upstream neurons, each firing at different frequencies, either causing either depolarizations or hyperpolarizations, but it still all adds up to either a sub-threshold potential or a threshold or greater potential. And threshold or greater, remember, doesn't change the magnitude of the action potentials because all action potentials are the same magnitude. Yeah, go ahead. Yes, there can be an upstream neuron sending a high frequency of inhibitory signals to the downstream neuron, and that's just really sending a lot of no votes all at once, which can, I mean, you would, if it were a simple situation of one upstream neuron and one downstream neuron, then there would be no need for inhibitory signals at any frequency. Even just a single action potential inhibitorily would do nothing that isn't already being done, namely that downstream neuron is not firing. You need inhibitory neurons, though, to undo the actions of stimulatory neurons that are also connected to that same downstream neuron. Does that make sense? Okay. Any questions on this? Okay, then let's look at slide 35. Here you have a couple kinds of inhibition. Inhibition is the general name that refers to the reduction in the tendency for a neuron to fire an action potential. So to inhibit is to keep it from reaching threshold, or to try to keep it from reaching threshold. And this can happen in a couple different ways. On part A of this slide, you have an excitatory neuron at 1. It's an excitatory neuron, which is the opposite of inhibitory, because the result of its neurotransmitter being released is such that it opens up probably sodium ion channels, which cause a depolarization, right? A depolarizing local potential that if there's enough neurotransmitter released, there's going to be a sufficiently great magnitude of depolarizing potential to bring the axon Hillock to action potential, which it does in this case. That's why you have an action potential propagating down on number 2. This axon happens to have three collaterals, three branches. each going to its own downstream target cell. But notice that that topmost branch, where you see the number 3, has another neuron involved. This is a special kind of connection, because the usual situation is for an axon terminal or presynaptic terminal to be innervating at a normal synapse. If it's a downstream neuron that it's innervating, it's going to be a connection between a presynaptic terminal, axon terminal, and a dendrite. So in other words, output to input. That's not what we have here, though. Here we have what is called an axoaxonal neuron, because it's an axon that is synapsing with another axon, hence the word axoaxonal, which, by the way, is spelled thus. And chemically speaking, the signal that's released from this axoaxonal neuron at 3 can be no different from the neurotransmitter that's being released from the main neuron. All right? But it's classified functionally differently because of this special situation of axon on axon. So what this axoaxonal neuron is releasing is classified as a neuromodulator rather than a neurotransmitter. To modulate is to adjust. So a neuromodulator has the effect of adjusting how much neurotransmitter is released from the main axon, or at least that branch of the main neuron's axon. All right, so normally without any input from this inhibitory neuron, all 3 of these branches would be releasing neurotransmitters and therefore stimulating each of the 3 target cells. Since this is an inhibitory neuron, it releases an inhibitory neuromodulator that has the effect of reducing the amount of neurotransmitter that's released from that branch that it synapses with. And therefore, this is a way of doing what I said, of accomplishing the same thing as what I said was impossible, namely that a neuron can't decide to send an action potential down just some of its branches and not the others. But if you have these axoaxonal neurons in place, then that's a way of at least causing some branches to be ineffective. So that's another way of having much greater control over the situation. All right, so that's presynaptic inhibition because it's happening before the synapse. On part B, which is postsynaptic inhibition, what you have here is simple spatial summation that I just talked about. You have 2 upstream neurons, one an inhibitory and one an excitatory. If they both send an action potential, then they both cause their own kind of local response in the cell at number 2, at the cell body. But those work against each other. You have a hyperpolarizing potential and a depolarizing potential, which sum together spatially as little or no change from resting. And therefore, you don't have action potential created at the axon hillock, and all of those branches are therefore inhibited because it's not firing. And so to add even more complexity, you can have both systems working at the same time. Is that a question? Okay, you're just pointing. Yeah, go ahead. Oh, that's a good question. How does an inhibitory neuron work? By causing different kinds of ion channels to be opened up. So if you open up, instead of a sodium ion channel, a potassium ion channel in the membrane of the cell body at the dendrite, then notice, even though it's also a positive ion, the gradient is reversed. The gradient is opposite for a potassium ion than it is for a sodium ion because of the continuous action of the sodium-potassium exchange pumps. There's always a much higher concentration of potassium ions intracellularly than extracellularly, and therefore, if those gated ion channels are open that are specific for potassium ions will flow out of the cell. That's an exportation of positives, meaning that the inside is going to become more negative. That's hyperpolarizing. The same thing would happen for a chloride ion channel, but for a slightly different reason. Chloride is an anion, it's a negative ion, but it's in greater abundance in the extracellular fluid, or greater concentration, and therefore it's going to come into the cell, but since it's negative, that's an importation of a negative, which has the same effect as the exportation of a positive. Okay? Does that make sense? So chloride ion channels, potassium ion channels lead to the opening of them lead to hyperpolarizations as their local potential response. Sodium ion channels opening up cause depolarizing local potentials. And remember that those gated ion channels are totally separate from the voltage-gated sodium and potassium ion channels that are responsible for the action potential. Because these chloride, potassium, and sodium ion channels that cause the local potential, what kind of gated channels are they? They are ligand-gated channels. Something has to bind to them to open them or close them. That's what a ligand is, something that binds to something. What is the ligand in general? The neurotransmitter. That's what the neurotransmitter serves as. The ligand that by binding will open up a ligand-gated ion channel. If it happens to be a neurotransmitter that binds to a chloride or a potassium ion channel, then that's going to cause a hyperpolarizing local potential. All right? Does that all make sense? All right, before I end this chapter, which that was the last slide, I want to go back and to a previous slide and talk a little bit more about the refractory period, because I introduced refractoriness, but I didn't break it down into its sub-periods. So slide 18 is where I forgot to mention the specifics of this. Remember that the refractory period, refractoriness, refers to comparative reduction in sensitivity of something. So for a neuron to be refractory means either unable or less able to produce an action potential. And the overall refractory period is, as you see here, the entire period of time that an action potential takes. In other words, from the beginning, the onset of action potential, which is right at threshold, all the way to the end of that action potential, which is defined as the return to resting. Okay, remember that there's the hyperpolarization that brings it even farther below resting, but then it comes back up and comes to equilibrium at rest again. That's the end of the action potential is right where the red line comes to resting again. And so that's the overall refractory period. But the two shadings in this figure illustrate that the overall refractory period is broken down into an absolute refractory period that occurs first, and then a relative refractory period right after it. Now the names give away the difference. The absolute refractory period is just that. It is absolutely refractory, meaning that during that time, it doesn't matter how big a stimulus is applied, you can't have another action potential created during that time. It is absolutely refractory, completely insensitive. And that's illustrated on the bottom graph by the fact that the green line, which indicates excitability of the cell, in other words, ability to create an action potential, is at zero during the absolute refractory period. As soon as the absolute refractory period is over, though, the neuron is still refractory. It's just only relatively refractory, because if an additional stimulus is applied at that time, if it's a big enough stimulus, which would therefore create a big enough depolarizing potential, then another action potential can be created during the relative refractory period. But it's a greater and greater threshold for creating that additional action potential the closer you are to the beginning of the relative refractory period, meaning that as soon as you're out of the absolute refractory period, that threshold is really set very high at that point, which is reflected on the green as being close to zero. The closer the green line is to zero, it really means the threshold is much higher. Does that make sense? Because low excitability means a high threshold for creating that action potential. But if the stimulus is big enough, then you could have another action potential created right at the beginning of that relative refractory period. As you proceed through the relative refractory period, the threshold gets closer and closer to the normal threshold. It comes down, which is illustrated by the excitability becoming higher and higher until you get to the normal high excitability that a neuron has at rest. Yeah, well, the sodium and the potassium curves, which are the amber and the purple, just show you their contribution to the actual membrane potential by virtue of their ion permeability. Notice that the yellow and the purple line have ion permeability as their units. Only the red one has action potential as millivolts. So the higher the trace is on the sodium or the potassium means the more flow of that ion there is through the membrane at that time. Yes. And how do you increase permeability of ions? By opening gates. And so the fact that the peak in the yellow sodium trace is farther to the left of the peak for the potassium ion trace is a graphical indication that the sodium ion channels are much quicker to open. As soon as threshold is reached, these sodium ions channels snap open. And that's why the depolarizing phase of the action potential, the steep rise in the red one, is caused by the influx of sodium ions, because those gates are already open. Now notice that at the very top of the figure you have the status of the gates on the channels. Sodium ions, remember, have two gates, because they need a gate to open them up and a gate to close to deactivate them. Potassium ions have only one gate. Well, the absolute refractory period is caused by the status of these sodium ion channel gates. It takes a while for these sodium ions channels to reset themselves. Not very long in terms of our experience, only a couple milliseconds, but that still makes a big difference. That's still a real amount of time. And unless these sodium ions channels get reset, it doesn't matter how big a stimulus you apply, you're not going to get any more flow of sodium ions. Does that make sense? So that's why once they are reset and you are now at the end of the absolute refractory period and the beginning of the relative refractory period, you can get more flow of sodium ions because those gates have been reset. But it takes more of a depolarizing potential, meaning the threshold is higher, because during this relative refractory period, you still have a bunch of open potassium ion channels. And as long as you have open potassium ion channels, since there's plenty of gradient, there's going to continue to be potassium ions flowing out. And if you have potassiums flowing out at the same time you have sodium flowing in, they undo each other. Right? It's exchanging one positive for another positive. It doesn't make any change to the membrane potential. That's why you'd have to have more sodium ion channels open than there are potassium ion channels still open from the previous action potential. It's not until you get things back to equilibrium, which is what the resting membrane potential is, that you get the normal threshold. And you're therefore done with that action potential, and you're out of the refractory period as a whole. Remember that the membrane potential, the resting membrane potential, is an equilibrium between, most importantly, the tendency for potassium ions to diffuse out of the cell after having been pumped in, creating the gradient. A conflict between that outward tendency for potassium ions and an inward tendency, which is electrostatic attraction back to the negatives that are gathering at the inner surface. When those two forces come to equilibrium, that is the resting membrane potential. Okay, so I understand refractoriness and the difference between the two periods. Now, this has two important implications, this refractory period. One is that, as I mentioned last time, this prevents an echoing effect, a backward flow of action potentials toward the axon hillock. Action potentials are propagated unidirectionally from the axon hillock to the axon terminal. Even though there's current flow, like I said, in both directions, that current flow backward toward the cell body doesn't cause another action potential because that little slice of membrane is in the refractory period. That was illustrated in slide 21. Right? There's current flow that would ordinarily bring this pink section on the third figure to threshold. But since that little pink slice of membrane is in the refractory period, it doesn't happen. And by the time this pink region gets out of its refractory period, there is no longer sufficient current flow to bring it to threshold. So there's only action potentials created in front of the current action potential, and it travels down the length of the axon. That's one important implication of the refractory period. The other is that it sets a maximum frequency of action potentials because the absolute refractory period says that you can't have another action potential until that absolute refractory period is over. Therefore, the absolutely maximum frequency of action potentials that a neuron can propagate is spaced in time to a time that is equal to that absolute refractory period. Does that make sense? You have the first one started. The highest frequency would be the closest spacing in time. That second action potential has to be after that entire absolute refractory period. So spacing them apart in time equal to the absolute refractory period is the maximum frequency of action potentials. And that's important because it keeps action potentials as discrete occurrences. You can't blend them together. But it's also important because of the way the nervous system encodes information. Okay, remember, there's a dichotomy here on these two information processing organ systems, endocrine and nervous system. The endocrine system encodes a strong stimulus as simply a big burst of release of hormone. A lot more hormone molecules are released in response to a big stimulus. That's amplitude modulation, AM, just like AM radio. The nervous system, on the other hand, operates via action potentials, and they are all the same magnitude. So it can't modulate the amplitude. It therefore modulates the frequency. Nervous system is FM, frequency modulated. A stronger stimulus is encoded as a higher frequency of action potentials within that neuron. Okay, you see the difference on those two? Any questions on that? let's go on to chapter 9, I guess it is. Chapter 9 has been mostly about the central nervous system, a little bit about its development, some anatomy that I think is important to know as well. This first slide, though, shows you that there's quite a bit of diversity among animals in the complexity of their nervous systems. You have a nerve net of a jellyfish, not very complicated, but it serves its purpose. All it needs to do is send a few signals. Then you start having primitive brains, ganglia. What is a ganglia? What is a ganglion? A ganglion is a bundle of cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system, in organisms that have both a central and a peripheral nervous system. Then you start getting things that look more like our brains, but of course not quite as big. We have, for our mass, we have pretty big brains. They pretty much fill our skull. If you've ever done a dissection of a sheep brain, for instance, sheep are about our mass. They're about the same size as we are, but their brain's only about that big, which makes them not as good a student. All right, so this, no surprising information there. It's just increasing complexity of brains. Slide 2 gives you the basics, very rudimentary basics of development of the central nervous system. And what happens is that early on in the embryo, there is a neural plate, what is called a neural plate, that forms ridges called neural crests that migrate toward each other and fold and meet, forming what is called the neural tube. And as expected, a tube is hollow. So the central nervous system develops as a hollow tube called the neural tube, illustrated by this, in cross-section on the bottom right, this lavender O-shaped thing. And that already reflects what the central nervous system as a whole is going to look like in the adult form, meaning that your central nervous system has hollow portions to it. There are spaces in the central nervous system which, of course, is the combination of the brain and the spinal cord. The spinal cord has a hollow interior. That hollow part is called the central canal of the spinal cord. And the spaces in the brain, what are they called? Ventricles, right, brain ventricles. They're all continuous with each other, meaning they're all connected, and they all contain what kind of fluid? Cerebrospinal fluid, right, which is important in supporting the brain. I mean, if you imagine, you also have fluid around the brain, which helps out. If you imagine having a raw egg in a jar, you drop that jar on the floor, the egg's pretty likely to break, right? But if you have a jar full of water with a raw egg in it, you drop it, that egg might survive uncracked. Similar situation with the fluid in and around the central nervous system. But the stuff of the brain and spinal cord all develop from this neural tube. All right, the hollow part becomes the hollow part. Slide 3 shows you how things start looking a little farther along. In part A, this neural tube has started changing shape and starting to twist as well. But you have development of what is called the forebrain, which some books will call the prosencephalon. Encephalon means brain. Cephalon means head, encephalon means brain. So another word for the for the forebrain is prosencephalon. But you also have the midbrain, which is mesencephalon. And the hindbrain, which is rhombencephalon at this point. Anyway, these are all going to develop into completely different structures that are part of the adult brain. And by using the coloring, you can match up what becomes what. So in C, which is farther along the line, of course, but still not ready for adulthood by any means, you see that the forebrain becomes the cerebrum. And the cerebrum is really, which the cerebrum means brain, by the way. And that's really what we think of when we, mostly when we talk about brains, is the cerebrum, the largest part of the brain, although it doesn't contain the most neurons. It is the largest by volume part of the brain. And it's the, it has the familiar wrinkles in it that make it look brainy. There, but the overall brain is more than just cerebrum. There are actually, most books will divide the brain into four primary divisions. Cerebrum is one. The diencephalon is another, and that's listed right under cerebrum on the upper right. And the diencephalon, I'll explain what's in the diencephalon in a minute. That's the second primary division. The third is the brain stem. And the fourth is the cerebellum. Cerebellum, by the way, means little brain. Because it looks kind of like a little version of the cerebrum. It has wrinkles in it as well. It has two hemispheres, right and left, and so on. So these are radically different in shape and function from each other, but they develop all from parts of this simple neural tube early on. Well, I'll have more to say about these divisions in a little bit, but let's look at the spinal cord, though. The spinal cord is the rest of the central nervous system. And slide 4 gives you a close-up of the spinal cord. Actually, what's shown here is a little more than the spinal cord. The yellow things that are hanging off of the spinal cord are spinal nerves. Spinal nerves are not part of the central nervous system. They're part of the peripheral nervous system. In fact, remember I said that nerve itself implies that it's peripheral, right? Because nerve means a bundle of axons occurring in the peripheral nervous system. Peripheral means at the periphery, at the edge. So you have central nervous system and all the stuff that's connected to it is the peripheral nervous system. The spinal cord itself is just this longitudinally running cord that when you look at it in cross-section, notice is made up of two different kinds of material, gray matter and white matter, which I'm sure you've heard of. And that this, the arrangement is that superficially, you have white matter. Deeper, you have gray matter, which curiously is just the opposite as how it's arranged in the brain. In the brain, you have gray matter superficially. The deeper stuff is the white matter. Okay? What's the difference between white matter and gray matter? Right. White matter is rendered white because of the existence of myelin. Myelin is whitish material. And so white matter is made up of myelinated axons. Because, remember, it's only axons, not the entire neuron, that are myelinated. Gray matter, on the other hand, is a combination of unmyelinated axons, because not all axons are myelinated, or it could be cell bodies of any kind. Cell bodies of even myelinated axons are themselves unmyelinated. All right? So gray matter is unmyelinated axons, but it also tends to be nuclei. What is the definition of a nucleus? It's a group of cell bodies in the central nervous system. Right? Remember the dichotomy? There's four terms: nerve, ganglion, nucleus, and tract. So there are no nerves technically in the central nervous system. There are tracts. Those are bundles of axons in the central nervous system. They can be either white matter or gray matter depending on myelination. A group of cell bodies in the central nervous system is a nucleus. And that also can be what gray matter is made up of. The spinal cord, of course, travels down through the hollow core of the vertebral column. Each vertebra is a bony encasement around this pretty important spinal cord. But there have to be ways for there to be nerves that come from or go to various parts in the body to connect to that spinal cord. So it's not just a, well, also we need to bend. But all of these connection points between the spinal cord and spinal nerves occur through holes in the vertebrae. And the general scheme is that there are four connection points at each level of the vertebra, of the vertebral column. There are two connection points in the front and two in the back. And the name for the front surface of a human is what? Ventral. Yes, this is my venter. Therefore, the adjective is ventral. My dorsum is my back surface, my posterior surface, which is, therefore, the adjective is dorsal. So these connection points between spinal nerves and the spinal cord are called roots. And there's a left and a right version, plus there's a front and a back version. Therefore, there is a right and left dorsal root, and there's a right and left ventral root. Now, you can tell them apart just by looking at a picture, because only the dorsal roots, only the ones that are positioned posteriorly, have what are called ganglia. In this case, dorsal root ganglia. See the little bulge? We're looking at this thing from the back, by the way, part C. We're looking at it from the back, which is why this thing that juts out from the vertebra, which is called the spinous process, that's facing us. Those are what you feel on your back, those spinous processes. So this is a back view, and therefore that the two roots facing you that have those little bulges in them are dorsal roots. And only the dorsal roots have these ganglia. And remember, those they're bulges here because a ganglion is a group of cell bodies. Right? And those take up a lot more room than the comparatively narrow axons do. Also, these root, different types of roots, ventral and dorsal, carry entirely different kinds of information. Each root is a one-way street as far as information flow is concerned. Dorsal roots, the ones with the ganglia, carry only afferent information. What is afferent information? Sensory. It's incoming, meaning it's sending information toward the spinal cord. So that's sensory information about stuff that's occurring in or on the body. Each ventral root, no matter which level you're talking about, carries only efferent information, which means motor information. That's information coming out from the spinal cord and going to some effector organ, either a muscle or a gland somewhere. But notice that on either side, the two roots, the ventral and the dorsal root, combine into a two-way street, which those are called spinal nerves. So spinal nerves are carrying simultaneously both afferent and efferent information, but it's important to realize that there is no neuron that ever sends information in both directions, right? It's the nerve, which is a bundle of axons, is a bundle of certain axons that always send information away, those are the motor neurons, and certain other axons that are parts of neurons that always send information toward the central nervous system, the sensory neurons. All right? Figure 5 gives you a view of these ventricles that are the spaces within the brain, and notice that they are continuous with the central canal, which runs down through the spinal cord. And this cerebrospinal fluid is produced by what? What kind of neuroglia create cerebrospinal fluid? Ependymal cells, good. Remember ependymal cells when we talked about neuroglia? Does anyone remember neuroglia in general? You had ependymal cells, astrocytes, things like that, neurolemmocytes. Yeah, the ependymal cells line the interior surface of these hollow structures, the ventricles and the central canal. And they continuously secrete this cerebrospinal fluid. And then eventually, as it circulates through by always being added at one place, will be drained into the blood circulation at venous sinuses, as they're called, up in the skull. So it circulates not as quickly and as forcefully as the blood does, because there's no heart, but it does circulate because it's always being created at one end and drained at another, and because of body movements, one of the many reasons why it's important to exercise. Gravity and things pushing on it pump it through. Slide 6 shows you a close-up of the specialized ependymal cells that actually create it. And it also shows you by arrows how this stuff flows through the hollow interior and also bathes the outer surface of the entire central nervous system. Figure 7 shows you a close-up of the exit points. These arachnoid villi, as they're called, or arachnoid granulations, some books call them, are places where the cerebrospinal fluid actually makes its way into the blood circulation, into veins. Why would it make it into veins and not arteries? Why is it a lot easier to dump things in? Why do you inject into a vein and not into an artery? Because it's much lower pressure, right? And cerebrospinal fluid isn't very highly pressurized because there's no heart. So you want to dump it into a place where there's low pressure also. If you try to dump it into an artery, all you're going to do is bleed into the ventricle, right? But anyway, the old circulated cerebrospinal fluid just becomes part of the blood. And continuously, new cerebrospinal fluid is being created by the ependymal cells. Slide 8 shows you astrocytes again. We've already talked about the fact that astrocytes have varied functions. We're learning more and more about them, but one important thing they do is form these foot processes, as they're called, that coat the surface of capillaries in the central nervous system. Remember, astrocytes are neuroglia of only the central nervous system. And this forms the so-called blood-brain barrier. It helps to form it because these foot processes allow for the creation of multiple tight junctions. Tight junctions are intercellular junctions, meaning between cells, that disallow movement of things between the cells. If you imagine a membrane is made out of individual cells. It's a sheet of cells, basically. And if there is a material that's trying to get from one side of the membrane to the other, there are two ways that it can get through that membrane. One is to go through the actual cells, enter a cell, and then exit that same cell on the other side, right? That's the transcellular route, meaning across the cells. But you could also just choose to go between the cells, because the cells are discrete things. They come together, but there are cracks between them. If you go in the cracks between the cells, that's called the paracellular route. so certain places in the body have tight junctions between the cells in order to disallow movement through that paracellular route. The reason that's important is that forcing something to go through cells means that it's then up to that cell what things make it through and what don't. By blocking the paracellular route, only the right stuff that the cell will allow can get through there. And so stuff that's in the blood, in the rest of the body, other than the central nervous system, a lot of that stuff gets exposed to the cells of the tissues because there aren't these tight junctions. But in the brain and spinal cord, only a very few number of things are able to cross that boundary, which is how certain drugs work while other drugs don't work as well. It's whether they can cross the blood-brain boundary. What I mean by certain drugs acting on the central nervous system. Drugs can affect other parts of the body as well, of course. Anyway, it's these foot processes of the astrocyte that maintain this blood-brain barrier. Now, slide 9 is another look at this spinal cord. The gray matter that you see on the interior of the spinal cord has this, most people think it's like a butterfly shape. I actually think it looks more like a moth. Well, it's gray. But anyway, there are so-called horns. The parts of the wing-like structures are called horns. And so there are dorsal horns and ventral horns, pointing toward the back and toward the front, respectively. And those occur all the way down the spinal cord. At certain parts of the spinal cord, you also have these lateral horns. Lateral means to the sides. And you don't have those all the way down the spinal cord because the only parts of the spinal cord that have lateral horns are the places of the spinal cord where the sympathetic division of the autonomic nervous system is connected, which is why it's labeled in blue as autonomic efferent nuclei. I'll explain more of this later when we talk specifically about the autonomic nervous system, but that happens only in basically the middle section of the length of the spinal cord. Notice you also have schematic representations of neurons. You see this in many books. A schematic representation of a neuron has the cell body labeled just as a circle. And then an axon is just a line. And the axon terminal is a half circle. Notice that in the front of the of the spinal cord, which in part B is the bottom of the figure, you have this efferent neuron shown just like I did, like I drew it. That circle in the lavender is the cell body. That's where that neuron begins. And then it exits the spinal cord through a ventral root because ventral roots carry only efferent information. This is a motor neuron. Okay? And that's going to go the whole way until it reaches a second neuron, which can be a long distance. Or it can go the entire way to a skeletal muscle. So these can be very, neurons of course can be very long cells. They're still individual cells. How can they be so big? How can they be so long? Because simply being long does not necessarily violate the constraint that's put on cell sizes by the surface area to volume ratio. You learned probably about this in 188, right? Cells are smallish. I mean, big things aren't made of huge cells. They're made of more small cells because cells have to be small in order to have a sufficiently high surface area to volume ratio. You have to have enough surface in order to service the interior. Well, axons are long, but they're not huge spheres. So even though they are long in one dimension, they still have a lot of surface area for their small volume. Also notice that on the incoming information on part B here, you have a sensory neuron, an afferent neuron, that whose schematic representation shows you the cell body connected along the length of the axon. What does that correspond to? What classification of neurons that we talked about? These are pseudo-unipolar neurons. Remember, pseudo-unipolar neurons have one straight shot from the dendrite to the axon without the cell body in between. Instead, the cell body is kind of hanging off to the side. That's exactly what you have, and those cell bodies all are taking up from many thousands of individual neurons are all taking up the same spot that forms that bulge in just the dorsal roots. And since they're cell bodies, and since it's the peripheral nervous system, those are called ganglia, dorsal root ganglia. You have none on the ventral root because those cell bodies are inside the spinal cord. And that's why those are called nuclei inside, because inside the spinal cord, you're officially part of the central nervous system. Group of cell bodies in the central nervous system is a nucleus. The right half of this slide shows you that the actual spinal cord itself, the white matter that is, consists of different tracts. That should make sense just on the basis of the definition of tracts, groups of axons in the central nervous system. But there are fundamentally two kinds of tracts, ascending tracts and descending tracts, referring to the direction of information through the spinal cord. Ascending, of course, means going up. So ascending tracts receive information in general from afferent neurons. Afferent neurons are sensory neurons. That sensory information then needs to be sent up to the brain. So it's sent through neurons that make up ascending tracts in the spinal cord. Descending tracts carry information from the brain that needs to be sent out through spinal nerves to the parts of the body that are the effector organs. And so descending tracts carry efferent or motor information, and they therefore send signals to motor neurons that leave the spinal cord through ventral roots. Okay, does that make sense? Does it not? Okay, I'll take that as an apathetic. And I think I'll stop there because I'll talk about reflexes next time.